It is the 3rd of September today, is it? Could be the 4th.
I think it's the 4th.
It is the 5th.
Oh, is it? Let's just choose a number, any number between 3 and 5.
It is the 5th of September. Hello and welcome to Season 2 of the Extraordinary Ordinary Women podcast. My name's Frankie, and this is the podcast where I cycle around the UK, interviewing folk about their adventurous lives. This season was recorded back in September 2020, as I cycle towards Liverpool and onwards north on my way to Scotland. This is episode 7 of season 2. I've pedalled my way to Healy Dell Nature Reserve, where Caroline lives. This episode was recorded on a pretty wet, very windy day. I've done what I can to edit out the wind, but please excuse it as we had to sit outside. I'm also convinced that it's not raining, whilst it rains basically the entire time. Usually I'd edit that out, but it's too funny not to keep in. Rain and wind aside, I hope you enjoy Caroline's incredible stories. So, for people that don't know you at all, can you give me a snapshot of who you are and what you do? Can I also ask how old you are? Because I always forget to ask that question if you are happy to...
I'm 62 and will be 63 in a month's time. Happy birthday to me for a month's time. So, yes, what am I? I don't know. How would I describe myself? I am a woman and I am 62. I live in a nature reserve in just outside Rochdale, and I work in sustainability and human rights, in particular women's rights. I have a son who's 27, and I have a cat called Thomas who's 17, and the son is called Adam. There we are. I just suddenly thought, I've named the cat, but not the son.
But they do have a name in real life, so that's okay.
So I've lived here for, in the nature reserve, I've lived here for 28 years, but have adventures elsewhere. Or maybe adventures here as well.
I'm really excited to find out a little bit more about your story, because you've talked a little bit about Africa and a little bit about all these different places you've been and these different things you've done, but can you put a bit of an order to it? How and when?
Originally, so I come from Gloucestershire, from Cheltenham. I went to art college and was studying graphic design, and at that time they did a competition for a student to design the first conservation charter for an African country, and my design won. So I went at the age of 18 to Africa, to the Gambia, as a guest of the president of the Gambia. It is the first time I had flown. It is the first time I'd been out of the country, any shape or form. So I was deposited into Africa and absolutely fell in love with it. Loved it, absolutely. So came back, finished my BA, did that. Then started work, became as a graphic designer for a local council. Did a lot of work with them on sort of events and things like that. And then decided that I wanted to go back overseas again if I could, and applied and got accepted for VSO. So I went as a VSO. Originally, I was going off to Zambia, and then it all fell through, and there was another job that was available in the Gambia where I had gone and done the Banjul Declaration. So I got sent there. So I went back to the country where I designed their Banjul Declaration, their charter for conservation, and I worked in agricultural extension and then moved into conservation work with the people that I'd obviously designed the charter for, and stayed there for 6 years. So I was only supposed to be there for two. So And then came back, decided that I needed to do a science qualification. So came back and went to Salford University, did my MSc in Salford in environmental resources, and then became the first recycling officer for the North West, known as the Queen of Junk at the time. And stayed here and then had my son and sort of moved different jobs. Then I was in the council doing the recycling officer, and then we had a thing called Agenda 21 where we had to engage with all of the communities to design a plan for sustainable living for the future for the whole of the borough. And through that got involved in all sorts of arts programs, so that was lovely to go back to a bit of arts. Did I go to then? Oh yes, yeah, so in that time I also went over to the Ukraine with the World Bank and worked with the Ukrainian government on community engagement and democracy, and then went to the Mersey Basin Trust. So I worked with all of the people that have anything to do with waterways. So we did lots of, it's a waterways charity, lots of work on canals and rivers, working with communities, and then basically through that work got taken as a consultant to go over to China, worked in China with the Chinese government on education for sustainability. And then through that work also went to India, went to work with a university in Tamil Nadu, which is a women's only university, teaching about sustainability again. So, and that's where I had my big adventure on the, I have to say, I am one of those people that has ridden an elephant. I do apologise. But out at 4 o'clock in the morning on the back of an elephant looking for tigers, there's not a lot that will beat that. Yeah, that's one of my key sort of big moments in my life.
Did you find any tigers?
No, but we saw some deer. I didn't mind, actually. I don't know what we'd have done if we actually had found a tiger. But yeah, amazing, amazing experience. Yeah, so India and then China and then back here working with a sustainability mill in Manchester. So the whole mill was sort of redesigned sustainably. So the whole building and the whole ethos of the building was about sustainability. And then from there moved to Sustrans, so worked on sustainable transport, so Yorkshire and the Humber. So that's the first time I've been to Hull. That was an adventure. And then from there, moved to Women Working Worldwide. So I work in women's rights in global supply chains. And then from that work, when I was in Holland and in Kenya, I met the people who run the MM Flowers, which is the company that I now work for as their sustainability manager. So that basically brings us up to date.
Amazing, what a journey. And I mean, I've got two questions already, but like, firstly, how did you go from never having flown before to flying and living and working all over the world?
I don't know, for me it was the big thing was obviously I was absolutely petrified. I can remember getting on the plane, and it was this way back in the mists of time, you wouldn't understand this, Frankie, but we had a menu. We stopped in Casablanca, so the plane had to be refueled. So there was probably about, I don't know, maybe about 100 people on the plane. So there was a menu. So you had a menu. I've still got the printed menu, and you could choose which one you wanted. And you had knives and forks that were made of metal. That's how long ago it was. And the plane stopped in Casablanca. I was so scared I didn't get off the plane. Everybody else got off the plane because it was being refueled. Everyone got off and sort of went off, and I thought, if I get off the plane, I don't know where I'm going. I'm 18, I've never flown before. I'd actually said to the guy sitting next to me, oh my God, the wings are shaking. And he went, yeah, if they didn't do that, you know, we'd fall out of the sky. Because obviously you have to have the flexibility of the wings. I didn't know that. But when I arrived in the Gambia, and it's a tiny little airport, and there, I just remember there being a 5-bar gate at the side, and the Gambians were sort of all watching, because everyone used to come to watch the plane come in. And I got off the plane, and I remember that wall of heat that hits you when you get into a really hot country. And I just thought, right, I'm going to get to the where the customs was. So I just picked up my bag, walked across the tarmac, down to the thing, and I walked past the group of people who were waiting for me, and they said afterwards that I had walked with such purpose they hadn't realised that I was the wet behind the ears kid from the UK. So I just think you just have to grasp it. You just have to go for it. And I just remember that one of the things somebody else said to me was when you're in a new place, don't walk like a tourist. Walk as if you own the place. Walk as if you know the place. So yeah, so I have an arrogance that perhaps gets me through quite a lot of things.
I love that.
But yeah, the travel bug was there, I think, from that moment. Was, and also to get back to Africa. I would go back, I mean, going back now, I obviously in COVID-19 it's a bit of difficulty, but it's on my list. I was supposed to go back to Kenya in February.
I was going to say, because living and working in the countries rather than just visiting for 2 weeks, you must have got to know them on a different level.
It is, I think, and I think that's the same for anyone that immerses themselves within a country. And there are people I know that obviously go back to maybe France every year, that they're, you know, they are so immersed within the French culture that it becomes almost a second home. I don't know. For me, it's always been about that immersion, and maybe that's what I do in all the work that I do. That there's very much a plunging in of something and just embracing something. And I do remember as an art student that whole 48 hours of just being totally focused on getting a piece of work done, and you know, almost not eating, not sleeping, and that immersion, I get a buzz out of that. It's like that moment when people talk about when they go on the stage, that if you haven't got the adrenaline, you're not going to perform well. But it's using that adrenaline in a positive way. So I get a real kick when I'm traveling, and I get a real buzz, and you could look at it as being anxiety, but I look at it as excitement, and it's flipping it. It's just thinking about it differently, I think.
I think there's a very fine line between the two, isn't there? And it's, yes, just what you call it.
Absolutely. And people say, you know, if you're not feeling that excitement, you don't perform as well. So, it's, you know, I just take that with me. So, yes, I am. So my sister will say things like, oh, you know, I couldn't do that. I get worried if I get on the wrong train. And I just go, so do I. And it's like, you know, like in India, thank God someone had said to me, when you fly into Mumbai, then you've got to get to an internal flight. But when you do that, you have to have your cases marked, and they'll take all the cases off the plane, put them on the tarmac, and you have to go out and identify, that's my case. Then they put a cross on it, and then they put it back in the other plane. And it's like, thank God someone had told me that, because some poor sod who was travelling, no one had told them that, and we thought there was a bomb. So there was this whole thing in the airport of like, oh, no one's identified this case, oh, it's going to be a bomb in it. But those sorts of things, it's like, you know, I would have been absolutely petrified, but someone gave me a little bit of information, and you get, take a little bit, and you think, okay, well, I can cope with that. I've got on the wrong train before now. I have got on the wrong plane, thank God, but
it's quite hard to do.
Well, you know that bit where they've gone, you're sort of queuing up, and it's like you're not quite sure which gate you're at. I've done that before. Gone off to Bristol instead of London.
It's not even the same direction, is it?
Yeah, but you know, again, sometimes it's interesting. I mean, for me, I just remember, I love the idea of, I do like travelling, I must admit. And I do, one of my favourites was, some friends of mine had got a place on Mull. So because I'm a good environmentalist, I decided I would go by public transport. I would get there by public transport. They'd already gone. They'd gone a week before, so I was joining them for the last week. So I remember leaving here and having to get a train to Hebden Bridge, and from Hebden Bridge to Preston. And then from Preston, the trains had stopped, so we had to get a bus to go to Carlisle to pick up the other train. and having a chat with someone from the oil fields on the bus and having an interesting environmental discussion, and then having to get on the train at Carlisle and then get into Glasgow. And then in Glasgow, you have to change from one station to the other. So you have to walk through Glasgow to find the other station, and having to ask people all the time, where's the station? And then getting to the station and then getting the train from there to Oban, and getting to Oban, but not enough time to get the ferry to go to Mull. So I had to stay the night in Oban and then...
This sounds like more of an adventure than the Gambia. It's amazing.
And then thinking, okay, I'll tell you what, I went out in a boat and then went to sea and got seals. So we went to see seals. And then we got on the boat to go the ferry to go across to Mull. And then you have to get a bus from... to get to the place, to the pub where they were going to meet me. By the time I got there, I felt like some sort of Victorian traveller in my crinolines. It's just like, it was such an adventure. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. So, yeah.
I probably had a way better time than if you'd have just jumped in a car.
Jumped in a car and just drove there. It's boring. But no, loved it. Absolutely loved it. And Mull was superb. If anyone gets a chance, go to Mull. Go to Mull and Iona as well. Very beautiful, very beautiful. Turquoise seas, gorgeous, absolutely lovely. Yeah, very much so. If you're going to Scotland, go and have a look. Mm-hmm. I thoroughly recommend.
I want to talk a little bit about the walking and the cycling that you do now.
Yes.
But before I do, can we just stick with India and China and all these amazing places? You say it like it's so easy that you just went and worked there and that was all there was to it and you were just there for a bit, but... How?
I don't, well, I suppose it's like many of these things. It's you're in the right place at the right time, and each one builds on the other. So, in particular, for China, was very much that when I was at Salford University doing my master's, I was an older, mature student. And I was like a kid in a sweet shop. For me, this was like I had come back into education. I loved it. I loved the fact I could go to the library and just sit there and read. A lot of the other guys on the course were coming straight out of their first degree. And they found the unlimitedness of it a little bit daunting. Whereas I just lapped it up. It was great. So a lot of the people who were teaching on that course, they had the connection. So they had a connection with the teacher training university in China. So through that and through the work that I was doing then on Agenda 21 and behaviour change and sustainability and education for sustainability, they just said, we'd like you to join our team. And that's what, so there was a team of us. I think there were 12 that went in the end for the first trip. So I was there four times. So at four different times to go. So, I was part of the team that went back and basically checked again. But again, some fantastic... So I have a friend who used to work in Singapore. So I thought, well, I'll combine that with going to China. So I'll go to Singapore first. So I went to see her in Singapore and then flew into China to meet up with the team. What I hadn't realised was that when you fly... from Singapore, you go into the local airport. So the delegation that was waiting for me as a visiting, you know, professory type person on the team, they were all in the international airport. So I arrived in China, first time I've ever been in China. I don't speak Chinese. I'm standing there. There's no one there to greet me. There's no one there to meet me. So I'm standing there thinking, okay, this is going to be a bit difficult. One of the guys in the airport saw that I was a bit lost and said, where was I going? And I said, all I know is I'm at East China Normal University, which is where they do the teacher training. And he went, oh, that's where I used to go. I was a student there. He said, I'll write it down on a piece of paper for you in Chinese. You go out of the airport. He said, avoid all the people that will try and get you to get in the taxis and just go to the government taxi and give him this piece of paper. So right off I go, out I go, give the guy this piece of paper, drives me to the university. We get to the university and he says, where? And I'm like, I have absolutely no idea where I'm supposed to be. So I just said, I don't know, I have no idea. And he said, international. And I went, oh, yeah.
That'll do.
So he takes me to the international students' accommodation. So I arrive at this place. No one knows. No one's speaking any English or anything. So they put me in a room, which was like you get in a normal sort of university setting. So it's got a bed, it's got a cupboard, it's got a sink, and then it's got a shared bathroom. And in the bathroom were a load of people from, I think, Ethiopia. And I remember sitting there thinking, now I know Ken, who was the person who was in charge of all this. I said, no, Ken said this is going to be a bit basic, but by God, I wasn't expecting it to be this basic. So I go downstairs and I think, well, I'll get a cup of coffee. So I go into the lounge area for a cup of coffee. There are a group of Chinese students playing, I think it was cards, and I'm sitting there drinking a cup of coffee thinking, I just got a feeling I'm not in the right place here. And then through the door came what could only be described as the Chinese equivalent of Columbo. And Columbo is the guy who had a glass eye and a bit of a squint and a long raincoat. And he came in and he said, are you Professor Downey? And I thought, well, I don't mind, I'll be a professor for the time being. And I went, yes. He said, I am Professor Guape. You are in the wrong place. And I went, oh, that's good to know. Anyway, so he picked me up, took me in, and then we went to this super duper, all singing, like four-star hotel type place. And I arrived at the banquet that was being held in our honour, and I came through the door, and Ken looked up and he went, there you are. He said, I told them you'd be all right. Wherever you'd got to, you'd be fine. Thank you, Ken. I was in the airport, not knowing where the hell I was. But that's the sort of thing that happens. That happens to me all the time. But just absolutely amazing. Lots of opportunities. And they came along, as I say, being in the right place at the right time. I've got to that stage. But no, it's not even a stage, let's be honest. I've done it all my life, which is something comes up. I haven't had a career plan. I know people that have done that and they've gone, you know, I need to go to this university, I need to study this and I need to do that. I've just gone with the flow. Wherever my heart has taken me, occasionally there might have been a few misturns. So yeah, I say to everybody, it's just like, yeah, no, take it, take the path.
It's interesting because one of my questions is always, do you feel like you've had a clear path or a clear sense of direction?
No. No. I don't think so. I really don't. The only thing, and it's one of the things that someone's sort of, like when you're doing your CV, is like, what's the thread that runs through it? And I think the only thread that I have is communication.
Ah, interesting.
If you think about it, it's like, you know, behaviour change, the whole idea about sustainability, the fact that, you know, I worked in graphic design, about communication, you know, the work that I did in Africa when I first went. Agricultural extension is about communicating some of the new things that we need to do. But I think, yeah, I think we've got... you've got an opportunity, as I say, to just seize it, go for it. Why not? Do you want to move to a sheltered spot?
Well, I don't think it's going to rain very heavily.
Okay, fine.
If it does, we can, but I think it's just going to spit. I think it'll be fine.
But yeah.
So tell me about your walking and your cycling that you do now.
Mm-hmm. So when I went to MN Flowers, I thought, right, this is it. I'm going to get a bike. I'm going to get a folding bike so I can take it on the train and then I can cycle to work. I hadn't realised quite how far it was.
How far is it?
It's not that far. For God's sake, I'm talking to someone who's cycling the entire UK. So I think it's probably only about 6 miles. It's not a huge amount, but it is even
for... Still a way to do there and back every day.
Absolutely. Anyway, so I bought the bike and I had to hone... great. Managed to get my first train trip down, and all of the trains. Constantly there's a story that goes with all these. So the train was cancelled and all sorts of things. So there I am with my lovely bike. And then they threw me off the train at Grantham instead of at, where should I have been, Peterborough or somewhere. It was a nightmare of a journey, absolute nightmare. So I thought, right, sod it. When I get to Huntingdon, I'll just get the bus. I'll take the bike on the bus and I'll cycle back. They wouldn't let me on the bus. So that was my first trip with my Dahoon. I've taken it out subsequently. I cycle when I can. I have my hybrid bike is inside. My bikes were stolen from here, which was very annoying. So I haven't replaced them for a while. But yeah, so I now have three bikes, which was a bit greedy of me. Going from none to three was a little bit much. So where we are now, there is a cycle path, a Sustrans cycle path at the top there. What I would like to do is to be able to take my bikes or bike with me. So this is quite hilly around here. I'm such a wuss. I don't like hills. I'm not into hills. I'll get off and walk. But they're there, and I'm determined to use them more. The walking, I just do that. That's every day. I walk out here, but we also have a walking group in Manchester. So there's a Manchester Weekend Walkers group. Sometimes I quite like walking with people, so, you know, 30 odd people, it's quite nice. Other times I'm quite happy to walk on my own or with, you know, an other. For me, it's just, I just love it. My sister and I go walking every year. We used to. So we would go mainly to Pembrokeshire to walk on the coastal path, which is probably my favourite place in the UK. Although when I was in Mull in Scotland, walking on moles, absolutely spectacular. And I would like to do, so this is sort of, you know, the bit where I said before about, you know, you get to 16, you start to sort of reflect and think about doing things for you. I would really like to do some of the sort of longer walks, you know, whether it's Way of the Roses or some of the bigger, longer walks.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think that would be nice. I think, but it isn't about having to do, you know, a certain amount. So I'm not really into the challenges where people are, you know, you've got to do, as I said before, 14 miles in whatever. I just like the idea of being able to sort of meander along somewhere at my own pace, sort of, you know, a rough idea of what likely to happen. I mean, it would be nice to do the Camino. I'd like to do that at some point. Maybe not all of it, but certainly some of it. But I'm walking in other countries. I mean, it's like, I think probably Portugal is one of the loveliest places I've walked in. Some glorious places, especially when the flowers are out in the spring. It's absolutely fantastic on the coastal path there. But yeah, I like the slowness of walking. The fact that you can actually get to know somewhere so well. And I mean, obviously the bike does the same thing. In a car, you're just whizzing through, and I like that. And the other one is riding, so I horse ride as well.
Oh, amazing.
And that to me, yeah, that's another level, absolute another level. I mean, you're on another living creature riding through some fantastic, spectacular countryside. So there's riding stables over in Saddleworth, so up on the moors. It's absolutely glorious. But again, probably one of my amazing rides would be either in Africa or in Scotland. Just riding out in Scotland is absolutely amazing. Lovely. Absolutely love it. So yeah, so all of those. I think walking, probably that's obviously the slowest. Quite like bike riding. And especially if you're off-road. I hate riding on the road, that's the only thing. So places like the Forest of Dean, I don't know if you've been there.
Oh, beautiful.
It is absolutely glorious, and they've got some fantastic trails there. So I'm a real... prefer to be off-road on a cycle path, not on the road. I'm a wuss.
How has your relationship with the outdoors fluctuated throughout your life? Have you always walked and cycled and ridden, or?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever changed. I think my earliest memory is probably being taken to ride a pony by my sister. And where we lived in Bishop's Cleeve is right next to the Cotswolds. So as a child, it would be, I mean, our parents didn't see us from, you know, I don't know, 8:30 in the morning till 6:30 at night. I don't think that I don't think they would even have thought about it. I mean, you know, we didn't have that, that relationship that I have with my son is completely different to what my parents had with me. So, yeah, I would either get on the pony or go up to the ponies and we would disappear, or we'd go walking, or we'd get on our bikes and annoy the train drivers on the train lines by waving at them from the bridges and things like that. But yeah, it's you know, in some respects, you look back and you think it's an idyllic childhood. You know, places close by, the Cotswolds, going up on the hillside, riding ponies. You know, it's like the, what's it, the Famous Five, isn't it? So it's like, I'm sure we had a dog called Timmy. we had Kip. We definitely had Kip. Yeah, and sort of, you know, working on the farms. So as a kid, I'd go and work at the riding stables to get free rides. So, you know, mucking out stables, looking after the sheep, rounding up the sheep on horseback. It was just, yeah, it was a childhood that I'm sure still exists in certain places, but not very much now. But yeah, so yeah, a love of the outdoors. Like I just, like I said about COVID-19, I cannot imagine what I would have been like had I been stuck in the centre of Manchester in a 14th floor flat or something. Good God, no. I thought I'd gone insane about 3 months in. So, and that's in our lovely surroundings that we're in now. So, yeah.
I think we mentioned earlier, but we are literally in the middle of a nature reserve, that looks like something out of Jurassic Park. I obviously live like quite an alternative lifestyle, you know, like go freelance and spend some time in my van. Every now and then, I feel like I might be trying to go against the grain a little bit. Is that something you've ever felt?
Only when people ask me. So I still have a lot of good friends who are in Gloucestershire, in around where I was born. And those people are the deeply rooted people. So I am seen as some sort of exotic because I've gone away. And they are mixed with other friends that I have. So there is a particular group of us that are very close, who worked and lived in the Gambia. So we've had a global reunion. Unfortunately, I couldn't get to it. It was in America. But we meet, the group of us that are in the UK meet, and we meet usually once a year. So those people are still, so one's in Australia, one's in Ireland, used to be in Switzerland. So we're all nomads in that sense, or at least working in different parts of the world. So I don't feel different when I'm with them. And then I suppose it's only when, if I'm in a work situation in particular, and it's, you know, I have, again, one of my key roles that I insisted on when I went to MM Flowers was to have the young lady that works there. So she is like my assistant. She's not, she's much more intelligent than I am on loads of things. But as far as I was concerned, I said what I wanted to do was to mentor her. So she has never moved really from that area around Cambridgeshire. So again, it is about sort of instilling, maybe, as you say, some of that instability with her in order to make her think she could go anywhere she wanted in the world to do anything that she wanted to do. Yeah, I suppose it depends. With certain people, I do feel, as I say, almost the exotic. But I've always said, I mean, it's like I had a long chat with somebody that I was at art college with, and I haven't spoken to them for ages. And I just said, you know, you look at me and think that I'm some sort of, you know, oh my God, you've been all over the world and whatever. I said, but I look at you and I think, wow, you have just got so much depth where you are. And there's a part of me that's slightly envious of that in some respects, which is that deeply rootedness. It's raining.
I know, it is. I might just pause this a minute. I've got my fingers crossed. I think it'll be okay. I've got a good feeling.
Okay. You've got a good feeling.
I've done. So today, I mean, it was completely pointless. Today and yesterday, every time it started spitting with rain, I just thought I'll cycle faster and I'll out-cycle it.
Well done.
Which made no sense at all, because I could have been cycling into it.
I understand exactly what you're doing. That's exactly what I do. Yeah. It's a bit like, I got a friend when we were in France in a van, and it was like, just follow the sun, follow the sun. And that was all we kept doing, was the clouds were behind us. It was just like, sunshine.
It's over there, yes, kicking it. Right, I can see it up there. So as long as this cloud is... If it's this cloud could just go to Manchester, we don't want that here.
Anyway.
You've had an amazing life, it sounds like, and journey. But how do you think your journey has shaped who you are now?
I'd like to think it's made me more open. I think most people... I was about to say... I'm just thinking what my friends would say. I can be quite belligerent about certain things. I can be quite... I like to think that I've got an open mind, which I do think I do have. But I know that there are certain givens within my framework which are very much around sort of the environmental side and the human rights side. And I don't think I'd ever change that. And that is something that's been with me since I was a teenager. I mean, my first big sort of real job when I was a 14-year-old was I volunteered with Protect Our Livestock. So it was animal rights. So I started in animal rights. So there's always been an element around that sort of fighting injustices and standing up for the underdog. And I suppose all of the jobs I've done has always been reinforcing that. And I know that, yeah, people will say that I don't suffer fools gladly. I think it's not fools that I don't suffer gladly. It is people who I don't think are kind, or people who are. It's like I've tried really hard around the whole Black Lives Matter and racism, and have almost fallen out with a lot of people. And it's made me realise that although I think that I am very open, that I have a line that gets drawn occasionally. And in some respects, I'm happy with that line. So whether what I've gone through in all of the different jobs and different things that I've done has made me, I don't know, whether it's to do with tolerance. I like to think I'm tolerant, and I like to think that I'm able to sit down and actually discuss with people a difference of opinion. And just because they have a different opinion to me doesn't mean I hate them or anything like that. I'm quite interested to learn what makes people tick. And in fact, that's part of the whole behaviour change stuff is to understand how people, what motivates people. And that whole psychology side of it is really interesting. But when I come, I suppose there has to be a point where I just go, no, 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 you have stepped over the line here, not happy. And I think in particular, I mean, this whole thing around, you know, all lives matter, and I'm just like, you just don't get this, do you? You really don't get this. And there are key people in my life who I've actually thought, do I just sever everything with them? Can I tolerate this? I really don't know. And I think obviously, you know, the fact that we've been in lockdown and COVID-19 and everything that's, you know, gone around, the whole sort of isolation stuff, I think is really... really beginning to, and it has a huge mental health toll. It's just, you know, I can feel my brain sometimes just sort of whirring and just going through it all and thinking, should I say something? Should I do something? And then sort of pulling myself back, which, you know, just calm down a little. But certainly it's, yeah, I think the ability to be able to engage with so many different types of people, I think has made me hopefully a better person, and hopefully a more tolerant person.
I feel like my 20s has been like this journey of trying to work out who I am and whether the decisions I'm making in the future are now who I am. And so I've been asking everybody about authenticity. Mm-hmm. And what do you think your authentic self means?
Yeah, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea. What is my authentic self? I know that everyone talks about the authenticity and, you know, you've got to be authentic in your relationships and all of that. I have no idea. I am who I am. I don't, what is authentic? Authentic to one person is something completely different to another. I know that, yes, for some people I am maybe too authentic. See, it's raining even more.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's just coming and going.
I used to have something on my wall that somebody gave me, and it was two women sitting on a couch and they're sort of, you know, talking to each other, and someone says, well, you know, I always tell the truth. And the other woman is saying to her, yes, and that's the side of you that no one can stand. And that is what people say about me. So is authenticity truthfulness? I don't know. I am as authentic as I possibly can be, but I'm sure that there are still parts of authentic people that are actually hidden, because there is, within everyone's life, there is so much, I suppose I wouldn't say trauma and angst, but there are, you know, as they say, you have no idea what shit other people are going through. So I think being authentic is about being open, I suppose. I'm sure that this is rain.
I think this might be rain now.
I think, Frankie, I think we're talking about rain here.
What do you think bravery is?
Well, the short answer would be feel the fear and do it anyway, obviously. It'll be different things to different people. So being brave for me would be completely different to being brave for you. So it depends what you're scared of. I'm scared of spiders. So for me, brave would be to be able to get a glass and pick the spider up and take it outside. That's bravery on a very low level. A lot of the time, yeah, there are times, yeah, when there are issues around public speaking being one. You know, and as everyone says, it's like I would rather die than do public speaking. So people always said that. So I have to publicly speak, whether I'm lecturing or whether I'm in the office giving some sort of training to someone or whatever. What I've found really weird is that as I've got more skilled at what I do, there are times when I'm absolutely petrified and I don't know why. I have no idea. There'll be something. Now, whether it's because I don't feel prepared or whether it's I just don't feel that people want to listen, there are times when I'm talking about global supply chains or whatever, or women, and I'm thinking, everyone knows this. Why is the point of my talking? No point in my talking whatsoever. So occasionally when I'm sort of preparing all of this, I have to be really brave in order to be able to stand up to do that talking, because I'm convinced that nobody's actually wanting to listen at all. And sometimes bravery can be letting go, meeting someone in a relationship and actually just going with the flow. It's like it can be so many different things. There's so many different ways that bravery comes out, whether it's, you know, standing up for someone on a train, when I've been on a train and somebody's been annoying a young lady and I've just gone and sat in between and intervened. I have maybe a switch that's inside me that doesn't recognize that. So I will jump in where angels fear to tread. So we had somebody was trying to break into the house next door, and I came home and I immediately challenged them. I didn't run away. So yeah, I just, maybe there's not a little switch inside that goes, this is dangerous. This is dangerous. Move away. Yeah, maybe I don't have one. So I don't know if that's brave, because that's just me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's interesting because my next question is always, would you describe yourself as brave?
I don't think so, no. I just do it. I, I don't ever look back. Obviously, as I said before, like I'm doing the self-reflection. There are times, yes, I suppose, when you look back and you just think, oh, I surprised myself there. But other times, I just get on with it, which is where that's the bit where I was saying about maybe that I'm slightly intolerant, which is sometimes I just think, what's the matter with these? Why don't they just go and do it? So for my sister coming up to visit is a classic example. So I'll say, just get on the train. Oh, I don't know. I might get on the wrong train. I'm like, for God's sake, Cheltenham is two platforms. That's all there is. One's going that way. One's going this way. So just get on the train. I will meet you. But what, when? What? And I'm going. So for her, the bravery side is getting on the train. Whereas for me, it's just like, what is wrong with this woman? To the extent where at one point she was coming up do Tai Chi in Manchester, and I actually had to photograph places in the station so that she knew exactly where she was going. So, you know, for me, then I'm looking at her and I'm thinking, she's the brave one because she is doing something which is so out of her comfort zone. That's bravery. That's, for me, that's bravery. And I suppose when I think about what do I do that's out of my comfort zone, so getting the bike again, that was out of my comfort zone because I hadn't had a bike since I was, you know, whatever, 30-odd. Then, of course, I went and worked for Sustran, so I had to ride a bike. Is that brave? I don't know. Sometimes going out for a walk on my own can feel like bravery in the sense that I don't want to particularly go out and I don't want to walk. I'd rather walk with somebody else, but I haven't got anyone to walk with, so I have to do it. So there are so many layers to the bravery. And, you know, as I say, somebody getting on a train is very brave for them. It's not for me. So, yeah, for me, I don't know. No, I don't consider myself brave at all. I consider myself to be a bit of a coward, actually. So, truth be known.
What do you think happiness feels like?
Happiness. Oh, that pursuit of happiness. Do we actually ever really want to be happy? I can be happy sitting out in the garden. It's a contentment in some respects. Or it can be fizzy and exciting. And it can be, you know, cycling down a hill or whatever. It could be with friends. It can be, this is a really sort of wiffly-waffly answer. It is so many different things to me. And I've had this conversation with other people before. It's like, I can be happy having a cup of tea in the garden. I can be happy in this fantastic, I don't know, arena where we're watching, I don't know, Leonard Cohen or whatever. It's, you know, that there are heightened areas of happiness. That idea of being able to smell horses. If I smell a horse, that's it, I'm happy. It's just there's a huge sort of invocation of all sorts of memories that go with it. And I can make myself unhappy by looking at certain things that will trigger memories within me. So I don't know. I think, you know, there are bits of clothing like those trousers. They make me happy. They make me happy because I've had them for so long. And they were made out of the curtains out of my house in Africa. So there's a connectivity. So maybe, I don't know, maybe happiness is all of those things, all combined. And I like other people being happy, and that makes me happy. I love the fact that if I can do something, random acts of kindness, I love doing, absolutely love doing. So, yeah, I'll buy flowers for someone. It's not their birthday or whatever, or I'll let somebody out at a junction or whatever. And it does. It just makes me feel good.
This is my last question.
All right, fine.
Thank you so much. But what's one piece of advice that you'd give to your younger self?
I suppose for my younger, it depends on how young. Just thinking, there's quite a few things I could say, but it's like for my younger self, and it's what I say to the girls that are part of our studenthood, is stand up for yourself, speak out, and yeah, don't take any shit. So yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? It's like we are so scared of speaking up because we think that we're wrong, but you're right. Whatever you say is right because it's what you're feeling, and that to me is fine.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me your time.
It's quite all right.
That was incredible.
I think I'm just amazed at what you're doing.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And if you know anyone who you think would like Caroline's story, please feel free to share it on with a friend. Extraordinary Ordinary listeners, we are going to be having a name change. I'm going to be announcing the new name of the podcast on socials, on Patreon, and on our newsletter this week. There'll be one more episode as Extraordinary Ordinary Women, and then we'll be changing the name. Make sure you join us on socials or sign up to the newsletter on extraordinaryordinarywomen.co not to miss future episodes. Thank you so much for joining. Till next time, keep on being extraordinary.